toxic chemicals from firefighting foam have found their way into private well water in Pennsylvania, where there's no solid plan to clean it up. The people affected are worried about the health and safety of their kids.
I want to move on. I want them to grow up and not worry about water.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, growing concerns over PFAS contamination. Plus, a building that saves energy and money with no electricity bill for air conditioning.
It takes heat from the building and it puts it in the ground during the summertime, and that antifreeze then comes up cool, and that coolness helps to keep the building cool.
And a man who is living the dream, making a living on the river.
I've had JOBs, and I never want to go back. My office is, you know, usually the boat.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Seven pipeline protesters in Lancaster County no longer face trespassing charges after reaching an agreement with prosecutors. State Impact Pennsylvania's Scott Blanchard reports they opposed the Atlantic Sunrise natural gas pipeline.
The group faced defiant trespass charges because in a cornfield almost 2 years ago, they blocked construction equipment for the pipeline. But Lancaster County prosecutors said they would drop the charges in exchange for community service. Pastor Melinda Clatterbuck, a defendant, says the group didn't accept the offer right away.
Some of us balked at that at first. We were like, no, if you're dismissing the charges, dismiss the charges. If not, we'll go to trial. You know, part of our desire in going to trial was to draw attention to the injustices that are in the system.
The defendants ended up doing 90 hours of environmental cleanup, almost twice the requirement. The protest took place on land that was owned by the Adorers of the Blood of Christ, an order of Catholic nuns that refused to sell to the pipeline builder. The company took the land by eminent domain. 23 people in all were arrested, and 16 pleaded no contest. The pipeline went into service last year. Scott Blanchard, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The invasive plant poison hemlock is popping up more and more across Pennsylvania. Invasive species can take over natural habitats and steal resources from local vegetation, says Sandy Feather with Penn State Extension.
I don't know if animals are moving the seed around, perhaps. I really can't explain why it seems like it's exploded the way it has, but there's definitely a lot more of it.
Poison hemlock isn't a tree. It's a plant that can be identified by its tall stalks and delicate white flowers. As the name suggests, it is poisonous if ingested and can be fatal. Check our website for a photo of this plant to avoid at AlleghenyFront.org. A toxic class of chemicals known as PFAS were once used in firefighting foam at former military air bases in Pennsylvania. The chemicals contaminated drinking water supplies, so public water authorities have installed treatment systems to provide safer water. The story is different when it comes to private wells, some of them miles from those air bases. WHYY's Dana Bate reports from Bucks County.
This is how Jody Cuter starts her day every other Friday, with a delivery from the water guy.
Have a nice day.
Thank you. Enjoy your weekend.
The Sellersville resident receives 5 51-pound boxes of water every 2 weeks, courtesy of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. Each box contains 6 1-gallon jugs of water. She, her husband, and 2 daughters go through a lot of it.
4 cases within 2 weeks, maybe 5? I don't really know.
4 cases, not 4 jugs, 4 cases.
We drink a lot of water. Between cooking and everything else, yeah.
Cuter has gotten these deliveries since 2017, when the DEP notified her that the levels of PFAS in her private well water were above the EPA health advisory of 70 parts per trillion. Her levels vary, but they've been as high as 133. Some of her neighbors' wells have been in the thousands. The fact that she even knows about this contamination is unusual. Pennsylvania is one of 2 states in the country that doesn't regulate private wells, so homeowners are on their own to test for contaminants. Many don't, and when they do, traditional tests don't include PFAS. Cutera found out because the DEP found elevated PFAS in a nearby public well and alerted her and her neighbors.
If this development was not here, people would be still drinking the water.
And having no idea.
Having no idea.
Cutera lives more than 15 miles from the former air bases in Warminster and Horsham. But her house in Sellersville is right behind Berge's Tires, where in 1986 there was a massive tire fire. More than 30 fire companies came to help put out the blaze, including ones from the former air bases. Cutera points to her neighbor's house.
Apparently, that yellow house was black. Foam was sitting in all their yards back there and all up there, just sitting there for weeks, apparently, afterwards.
The DEP is still investigating the source of PFAS in the private wells in Sellersville. Regional Director Patrick Patterson says the agency is trying to be responsible and not rush to conclusions.
We want to work with what the science tells us, so that's what we're hoping to do by doing a thorough investigation.
The water delivery is only a temporary measure. The DEP wants to install filtration systems in these homes, which would take the PFAS levels down to zero.
The quickest way to get good water to people is through this filtration system, and the most cost-effective.
But Cutera and some of her neighbors don't want filters, which break down over time and are expensive to replace. Filters also need to be swapped out regularly in order to work, and the used ones contain high levels of PFAS. Cutera lives in Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick's district, and he brought this up at a recent meeting.
A lot of people just dispose them in their trash cans. It's a public safety hazard of a whole separate degree.
Cutera wants public water, but hooking up her and her 11 neighbors would cost $2 million. And Patterson says if people stop using their wells, the PFAS plume could spread because the water is no longer being pumped out of the ground. Regardless of whether she gets a filter or public water, Patterson says she will need an environmental covenant attached to her deed telling people the water is contaminated.
Especially if there was a public water system, because then you'd have all this untreated groundwater. And you would have to tell people they couldn't use it to water their lawn, they couldn't use it for anything.
That concerns Cutera, who's already seen her property value drop. She put plans for an addition on hold and worries she'll never be able to sell her house if she needs to.
All right, you ready? Go get the bus.
Yes!
She also worries about her two young daughters. Her youngest, Emily, is 8 and knows about the water contamination.
We can use it in the bath, just you can't drink it.
Cutera wants answers and action, two things she says she isn't getting.
I want to move on. I want them to grow up and not worry about water.
But for now, she continues to worry every time she turns on the tap. Dana Bate, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
A plant in West Virginia is putting trash to a better use than letting it sit in a landfill, by converting it into fuel.
There's not going to be one fuel, one power source that's going to fix the energy issues that we face. But you might as well be using waste, because that's a definite recyclable commodity. Everybody makes waste.
Later on the Allegheny Front, inside the facility, using a unique technology to turn trash into fuel. Fast. That's coming up. The discussion around climate change often focuses on how to ramp up carbon-neutral forms of energy, like building more wind farms or solar panels. But if the world is to achieve the 2015 Paris climate goals and avoid the worst effects of global warming, people will also need to start using energy more efficiently. As part of State Impact Pennsylvania's ongoing climate coverage, Marie Cusick takes a look at a new building that aims to be a model for that future.
During the summer at Millersville University, things quiet down. It's a good time for prospective students and their parents to check out the campus in Lancaster County.
We're here for a tour.
Okay, and the name of the student?
The first stop on the tour is a modern, light-filled building with flags from more than a dozen countries hanging from the ceiling, representing the school's international students.
You are currently in the newest building at Millersville, so this is the Lombardo Welcome Center.
The $10 million structure is the first building in Pennsylvania to be certified as a zero-energy building by the International Living Future Institute. It's a Seattle-based organization that promotes sustainable construction.
Net zero means that it produces as much energy as it consumes during a year.
That's Kathy Schreiber, a professor who teaches sustainability at Millersville. She says the building actually does better than net zero. During its first year of operation, it generated 75% more energy than it consumed. That's thanks to more than 500 solar panels on the roof, plus a ground-mounted solar array that tracks the sun's path across the sky each day, and 20 geothermal wells outside on the lawn. They don't look like much on the surface, but they help keep the building warm in the winter and cool in the summer.
It's a little circular device. It's just a small cement circle on the ground with a metal circle in the middle, and the well goes down about 400 feet into the ground.
She said the temperature down there is around 54 degrees Fahrenheit year-round.
So what we can do is we have an antifreeze that goes down, and it takes heat from the building, and it puts it in the ground during the summertime, and that antifreeze then comes up cool, and that coolness helps to keep the building cool.
It works the same way in reverse during the winter. Back inside the atrium of the building, at first glance, the soaring glass walls look similar to those in many modern buildings, but move in a little bit closer and you can see small gray dots scattered on the glass. Those help block sunlight, another way to conserve energy on a hot summer day. It's all part of Millersville's goal to be carbon neutral by 2040. And while buildings like this one are still relatively rare, they can serve as an example of why energy efficiency matters. That's according to Julian Boggs. He's with the Keystone Energy Efficiency Alliance. He says it can be a bit complicated to think about how to use energy efficiency to meet climate goals.
And in fact, that's a little bit counterintuitive, the idea that energy efficiency is itself an energy resource and that we can meet our energy demand not by building a wind farm or a solar panel or a nuclear power plant or a gas power plant, but by reducing our demand.
Reducing demand ultimately means using fewer resources and creating fewer harmful emissions. Boggs spends a lot of time in Harrisburg talking with lawmakers. He says the basic concept of not wasting energy is something both parties can agree on.
I have never run into a legislator who says, I do not think we should be more energy efficient, or I do not support energy efficiency.
Boggs says there have been some recent successes in Pennsylvania. For example, a year ago, the legislature approved and Governor Tom Wolf signed a new law known as Commercial Property Assessed Clean Energy. It's a voluntary program local governments can opt into. It helps commercial property owners finance the often expensive upfront costs of energy efficiency upgrades, like better insulation, new hot water heaters, or solar panels. And Boggs says the state took another leap forward last year when it updated what's known as the International Energy Conservation Code standards, a 30% energy efficiency improvement over the previous version of the code.
So new construction, if those new construction buildings are up to code, are significantly more energy efficient than new construction that was up to code a few years before.
In January, Governor Wolf signed an executive order directing state agencies to reduce their energy consumption by 3% each year, with the goal of hitting a 21% reduction in 6 years.
When you're looking at the state government, at least, reducing energy use 21% by 2025 is enormous.
He says even though energy efficiency can often be more complex than screwing in a few LED light bulbs, policymakers can help smooth the way by creating new energy-saving programs and financing options.
I think it's important that we create the incentives and space for the energy companies, energy efficiency service providers, and utilities to make that easy and available for everyone.
Back at Millersville, Dylan Rohr is getting ready to show off the energy-efficient features of the new Welcome Center for the next tour coming in. Rohr recently graduated with a degree in psychology and says sustainability is not something he used to think about much, but walking around in here has given him a new appreciation for the world's environmental challenges and solutions.
Yeah, I think it's something that not just my generation, but future generations will definitely have to be facing.
He says the new building has become one of his favorite spots on campus. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania, Lancaster County.
Recently, President Trump and members of his administration spoke about their environmental policies over the last 2 years.
When I ran for president, I pledged a strong, growing economy and a healthy environment because I believe that we can pursue both at the same time. We have only one America. We have only one planet. That's why every day of my presidency, we will fight for a cleaner environment and a better quality of life for every one of our great citizens.
But others see his denial of human-caused climate change, his removal of the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement, and his propping up of the coal industry a lot differently.
He's actually engaged in one of the most significant environmental rollbacks in U.S. history. I would say it's the most significant.
On the latest episode of the Trump on Earth podcast, an environmental law professor provides her take on Trump's presidency so far. That's at TrumpOnEarth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Today, most of our trash ends up in landfills. In the United States, we produce more than 200 million tons of trash every year. What if we could turn some of that trash into fuel? As Liz McCormick reports, a large portion of residents' trash in Berkeley, Jefferson, and Morgan counties in West Virginia is being turned into fuel, even if they might not realize it yet.
This is it.
That's what it looks like.
And isn't it safe to touch, too?
Yeah, it's like all stabilized.
Confetti or something?
Emily Dyson opens a gallon-sized Ziploc bag full of soft, confetti-like material. It has no smell, and it looks kind of like colorful shredded fabric. This stuff was garbage, and now it's been broken down, cleaned, and can be used as a fuel source. Dyson is a scientist, and she directs the research and operations here at Insorga, West Virginia, a new waste-to-energy facility located in Martinsburg. There are similar efforts to turn trash into energy elsewhere in the United States, but this one is the first in the country to use a unique technology called HYBIOT, or high-efficiency biological treatment. It speeds up the process, turning trash to fuel in less than 3 weeks. Insorga is based in Italy. Its technology senses and separates garbage to collect biomass, plastics, and other carbon-based materials. Then, through the use of large fans and mulch, yes, mulch, the garbage is cleaned, composted, then separated and shredded, and can then be used as fuel. Dyson says this sort of technology will solve a lot of waste and fuel problems, but is only one piece of the puzzle.
From a waste perspective, there's not going to be one technology that's going to solve the waste problems of the U.S. From a fuel perspective, there's not going to be one fuel, one power source that's going to fix the energy issues that we face here. But you might as well be using waste, because that's a definite recyclable commodity. Everybody makes waste.
Dyson says nearly 80% of garbage that comes to Insorga will be diverted from a landfill, and at least half of that will be turned into fuel. Fuel that will be used at a local cement factory in Berkeley County. Insorga's fuel will also replace a portion of coal used there.
It burns cleaner than coal. The cement plant will use up to 30% offset or supplement of their coal.
Insorga, West Virginia opened its doors this spring, and it's having a considerable effect on lessening the amount of garbage going into a landfill. Clint Hogben, chairman of the Berkeley County Solid Waste Authority and who invited Insorga to locate to West Virginia, says in its first full month of operation, the facility saw more than 1,000 tons of waste that either became fuel or was recycled at the Berkeley County Solid Waste Authority.
That's an immediate 10% landfill reduction in their first month for the entire Eastern Panhandle. If you add all the waste stream of the three county Eastern Panhandle. That's in their first month, it's immediate 10% landfill reduction.
But let's back up. How does garbage become the fluffy stuff we saw in that Ziploc bag? Well, here's how it works.
So basically, I'll give you the overview here. Trucks come in, they scale in. Everything about this plant is automated.
Residents in Berkeley, Jefferson, and Morgan counties take their garbage out to the curb once a week, like anywhere else. But only Apple Valley Waste customers see their trash sent to Ensorga. The Ensorga facility sits just behind the Solid Waste Authority on 12 acres of land. The garbage trucks are weighed, and then the contents are emptied into the Ensorga building. After the trash is dropped off, Ensorga's Hibiot technology begins its work. There's no human intervention in the Ensorga process, just the employees who operate the machines and watch the monitors.
So this is the control room. Hi, guys. Material is picked up with that big crane right there.
A large screen shows multiple camera views of the machines at work, spinning, cleaning, or shredding the garbage. Dyson says the waste will sit in what's called the biooxidation hall for a couple weeks, while a large fan system sucks and blows air through the ventilation system.
And that is what accelerates that composting, because we're drying that material out fast. What normally takes 3 to 9 months, we're doing in that 10 to 14, 16 days.
Mulch plays a big part of the ventilation process by absorbing and breaking down the garbage smells. It helps to clean and compost the trash that'll eventually become fuel. But getting Ensorga to locate to West Virginia has not been without its struggles. It took 10 years to get all the permits cleared, in part because the facility was a brand new thing for the state, and there was also some pushback from community members.
The first public hearing, there was a lot of people, there was a lot of questions.
She says most of the concerns came from a lack of understanding about how the technology works.
It's hard to wrap your head around that unless you see it.
There was also some opposition by landfill companies. Again, here's Clint Hogben with the Berkeley County Solid Waste Authority.
If you're a landfill, if you're a facility that's going to lose a lot of intake because of this facility, you might be upset and you might get involved and slow it down. So we had some of that.
Hogben says the Eastern Panhandle needed a waste-to-energy facility simply because of the rate at which the area is growing, to find an alternative to landfilling. And he says he hopes Ensorga, West Virginia, will be an example for the rest of the country.
I'm hoping those solid waste decision makers will come to Martinsburg, visit the facility, and I'm hoping in that way the ripple effect would be that, and that West Virginia changed the direction of management of solid waste. It might be nice to be first at something.
Ensorga, West Virginia's fuel product is being utilized by one local cement plant in Martinsburg. But both Hogben and Dyson say there are other cement companies who may contract with them in the future. And there's the possibility that other companies may have an interest in the product, too. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in Martinsburg.
For most people, summer is synonymous with vacation. But for the people who make a living off those vacationers, this season is all business. Last summer, Avi Wolfman-Arendt took us to the middle of the Delaware River for this story.
On a mild stretch of river just south of Frenchtown, New Jersey, you'll find the perfect blend of classical elements. There's water, wind, and fire.
When I go on the river to this day, all my problems go away.
That's Greg Kranz. He's responsible for the fire part. In the late 80s, a local businessman came to Kranz with a problem. The businessman rented tubes to people who would float down the river and sometimes trash the place in the process. The people who owned fancy homes on the Pennsylvania side of the river weren't exactly happy with him.
they were complaining that people would, during a storm, would go across their property, or they would bring coolers or alcohol.
The businessman told Krantz he should open a hot dog stand in the middle of the river. It would tempt the tubers to stay toward the other bank instead of crisscrossing all over the neighbor's property. Plus, it would keep them from bringing their own food and trashing up the river.
I said, nah, that's a crazy idea. And then he brought it up again a week or two later. And we said, all right, we'll give it a try. And that's when we were all joking around. Oh, yeah, we're going to be the famous river hot dog man. And we went out and did it.
Over 31 years, Krantz has become kind of famous, at least among the thousands of tubers who float by his stand on summer days. The business started on the banks of a small island, but today he and his family sell hot dogs, burgers, nachos, candy bars, chips, and sodas from a floating barge in the middle of the Delaware River.
Can you get a hot dog, chips, and a drink?
Yeah. I've had J.O.B.'s, and I never want to go back. My office is, you know, usually the boat.
These days, Krantz has ceded a lot of the work to his four sons. Matthew is the chief operating officer.
I'm a hot dog man, but he's the original hot dog man.
15 years ago, the family opened their own tubing business, Delaware River Tubing. Together with the hot dog stand, they make enough money to get by. But it can be a fickle trade.
Our weekend business is 60% of the organization. So if we lose two weekends, that hurts us big time. I mean, we're only dealing with 12 solid weeks of operation.
Matt's salary can fluctuate wildly from year to year based on how good the weather is on those 24 days of weekend during the summer. We're talking tens of thousands of dollars.
River taketh, river giveth.
So how does the famous river hot dog man stay sane given the crazy swings in his bottom line?
I don't handle the sanity all too well. Take pills for that.
And working on the water, it turns out, is its own form of medicine.
It still has that soothing effect on it. So if you haven't been out there and you haven't tried it, you need to. And you need to come with us. You need to see the hot dog man. You need to kick back, listen to some music, and let your kids tear the place up. We don't care. They can't hurt it.
But Krantz says this is more than a business pitch to him. He considers tubing a form of what he calls conservation by immersion.
We need the Delaware, and everyone needs to appreciate it. And so what I mean by immersion is people come, they go in, just letting them have that experience, seeing how clean it is, pristine. Hopefully thousands of people go back home and realize how important it is to keep it that way.
One dip in the Delaware, Krantz says, and you'll appreciate everything the river offers. And of course, you can't appreciate anything fully on an empty stomach. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Is anybody else in the mood for a hot dog right now? Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and our podcast, Trump on Earth. All of those episodes are at trumponearth.org. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation, the Sears Sweatland Family Foundation supports our coverage in Ohio, and the Robert F. Schuman Foundation supports our podcast, Trump on Earth. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.